Again, the BadQuaker.com podcast. This podcast is the first of the series that we recorded here at the 2012 New Hampshire Porcupine Liberty Festival. These were recorded outdoors with a lot of background noise and a lot of sound. The one you're going to hear today is with Boston Tea Party. So without anything further, I'm just going to go ahead and go into this. This is Ben Stone, and I'm here with Boston Tea Party, the author, and what might be called you. The Free State, Wyoming Free State Project was basically your baby, isn't it?
Yeah, I founded that. I started my own Free State idea after Hologram of Liberty in 97. Finished that book, and it's like, now what do we do? What are our best chances for liberty in this country? And I thought that regionalism was really our only hope. I had, at that point, given up on trying to educate and convert, you know, the entire country. It's a large country, 300 million, and too many of those 300 million are going to do what they want to do, and you know,
right,
regardless of our principles and books and so forth. So it's like, okay, what do we do? Now that the Constitution, in my mind, is not the answer, it's part of the problem. So I came up with the idea of concentration of folks like us in a sparsely populated state. And by 97, the summer, I was already going to Wyoming for research for the novel that turned out to be titled Mull on the Bay, which is Greek for come and take them from the Battle of Thermopylae. But in 2001, I was quite serious about starting an org of my own in the summer, and right around 9/11, I learned about Jason Sorens and his idea, which is what it was at that point in the summer of 2001, for a Free State Project, and then the vote and all that. So I was involved in some early promotion of the FSP, was their titular 5,000th member, which kicked off the vote. I had opted out of everything except for Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, because I firmly believe in the Western culture as being necessary for a freedom movement area. And also, they're sparsely populated. So when the FSP chose New Hampshire, I knew that there was going to be pent up and unsatisfied demand for a Western alternative.
Right.
Just as if had they chosen Wyoming instead of New Hampshire, there would have been pent up and unsatisfied demand for for New Hampshire or Vermont or something. So there was always going to be two east-west movements. So it was my curse or fortune to found the FSW, which I did in the end of 2003. I think the vote was 2003. And Mull on the Bay came out in January. So yeah, founder of FSW. We've had over a couple hundred movers there. We've got hundreds more slated to come in. We've got over 9,000 people in our forum. And it's a good, viable second choice to someone that wants to be part of the Free State movement, but you know, maybe New Hampshire or the Northeast doesn't work for them. So you know, have a look at Wyoming and the FSW. You know,
Wyoming also has a wide variety of landscape and weather as well, because you don't, a lot of people think of Wyoming, I think, maybe as just mountains and so forth, but you've got some nice big plains there. You've got valleys. It's a very diverse state.
Sure. Yeah, the actual name of Wyoming comes from an Indian term, which I, or name that I don't recall, but it means land of the Great Plains. So most of Wyoming then is like that, grassland plains and so forth. We've got two mountain ranges, basically, maybe a third, you know, coming up from Colorado, but you've got the Tetons and you've got the Bighorn Mountains. Then down by Sarasota, you've got some mountains. And then part of the Black Hills from South Dakota spills into the northeast corner of Wyoming. which is kind of our epicenter as Free State Wyoming folks, mm-hmm. would be in Crook and Weston County. And then I think Casper would probably be like the next largest concentration of us. So big booming economic things going on there. Easy to get a job. It's a good business state if you bring your business in. It's easy to get to Denver or other places from our small airports, and then from Denver or Salt Lake you can get anywhere else. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big open state, and it's in the middle of the country, but that doesn't have to be a sacrifice in the 21st century. It's much easier to live, work, and thrive there than it used to be. So
right.
I see Wyoming and Montana and the inland west mountain states as being on the rise for many reasons. So, you know, it resonates with some folks, cool. If not, the FSB in New Hampshire is also a great choice.
Now, Wyoming has the law where if a firearm is manufactured there,
right.
then it's pretty much off limits for the feds to do anything.
That's right.
As long as it's manufactured, bought, and sold within the state.
Right, and kept in the state. Nine states, including Wyoming, have passed what are called generically the Firearm Freedom Act, which basically is trying to negate the influence of the Interstate Commerce Clause in Article 1 of the Constitution, which gives the feds the alleged power to dictate, you know, what, regulatory powers over pretty much everything we do. And so the idea behind the FFAs is that, all right, we can regulate interstate commerce, we're going to keep this intrastate within the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wyoming was one of the first states to pass that. Montana was the first. And the fellow behind getting that energized was Gary Marbit of the Montana State Shooting Association, the MSSA, which has done great work in the legislature with bills protecting rights of gun owners and hunters and so forth. And Gary Marbit floated that in 05, and in 04, the year before, I gave him a copy of Moulin LeBay where this idea was in there about mm-hmm. making guns within the state as an interstate thing. So I like to think that life imitates art in this respect, and these FFAs really had the nucleus originally in, you know, the mind of a particular novelist that wrote Moulin LeBay. So I like seeing these things out there. And Wyoming's version of the FFA is the only one of the nine states that has enforcement powers, where state officials will arrest an ATF agent that comes in and tries to arrest a Wyoming person making made-in-Wyoming guns. So that's yet to be tested, but it's very exciting that this is on the books.
And the testing process, we actually need that to happen. The testing process would yes. involve someone who can take the risk, who right. understands the risk, can take the risk,
yeah.
and is willing to step up and manufacture mm-hmm. An item,
right.
Be that a 22, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. I heard you mention before, 22 rifle or 22 pistol or something.
Something simple, yeah.
And machine it out in their garage in a basic but safe manner,
right.
And sell it,
right.
And let's see if we can take this thing to as far as it'll go and win.
Agreed, yeah. Gary Marbit tried to sue, saying, you know, I'd like to sell my little 22 rifle for kids that I'm making, but I'm prohibited because of this law. And they said, well, you have no injury, you know, from some, you know, alleged income lost out of a theoretical business you never started. So you have no standing, Mr. Marbit. So someone needs to do this. Just like Dick Heller went to the D.C. police to get a permit for his handgun, which allegedly would be issued, and they denied him. He got proof of that denial.
Right.
And so
that gave the grounds to go ahead
yes,
with the Keller case.
He had legal standing and a way to prove it. No one had done that. And it was Dick's friend, Dane von Ruschenbreischart, who was sort of like Dick's legal eagle, that said, you got to get standing, you know, mm-hmm. to have some skin in this game, basically. And it's the same thing with the FFA. So I hope that someone steps forward.
Yeah.
It's not going to be me. I'm not going to put my head on that chopping block, because it rather is a chopping block.
And yeah.
You're almost guaranteed to get a felony arrest and probably a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, otherwise, if no one tries this, it's moot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it needs to be somebody who is not going to be tainted with anything else
right.
that they can, shift the topic towards.
Yeah.
I'm right. thinking of how they tend to, I don't want to go into specifics and pull anybody specific into it, but they tend to, well, I'll give an example. There was a guy not long ago who was having a divorce problem with his wife. Mm-hmm. And so she called the police on him and said, you know, he has a gun range inside his house, and he has a gun collection, and he has MREs and other food storage.
Yeah,
and
survival
and,
nut.
Yeah, and so they came in, the press was there, they made a big deal, they raided him, they took everything down. And then after they got all done, they never charged him with anything.
Yeah.
Because he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, you know, not even wrong. He didn't do anything illegal. Was, you know, making the distinction there.
Right, right.
And in his case, there was, you know, if they would have found, let's say, a gram of some, you know, a tiny gram of some substance that's illegal, he would have had no position at all.
Yeah.
Everything they would have done would have been justified to the mindless public out there.
Right.
Even though it's not justified.
Right.
It would have been to the public. Of course, look, he's a drug nut, or he's a if he'd have had a single illegal firearm among his collection, that would have to the public. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Heck, it could even have a Playboy magazine. They can say, we found pornography in the house.
Yeah.
And then later on it's child pornography in the game of telephone, and you know.
So whoever tests this
needs
to be a person who is, to you know, to use the terminology, is clean,
right,
and can present a perfect case.
You know what would be, I'm just thinking about this now, what would be an ideal test subject theoretically? It would be a veteran, it would be someone retired, mild physical ailment, for some sympathy factor, make him a widower, okay. Make him a minority. He's black or Hispanic.
Yeah.
He's in a wheelchair from the Korean War.
Yeah.
And he's doing this to make ends meet because he's always been a machinist and a gun enthusiast and all that. Perfect record. Da da da.
Yeah.
You know, go arrest that guy.
Yep.
And see what turds you look like.
Not back on his taxes and nothing like
exactly.
that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yep. Neighbors love him. You know. Town councilman back in 74. Whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Saved a puppy.
Saved a puppy. Has the t-shirt, right?
Oh boy.
But yeah, we need to get proactive on this. So I'm calling on, I'll kick this off. I'm calling for someone to like give this a try.
Yeah.
And you know, meet with attorneys first and plan all this out.
Right.
And Dick Heller, in a way, with the DC versus Heller case, he was a test case and went in this, they plotted and planned this. Mm. And he was the ideal plaintiff. On this thing.
Yeah.
And that's A, why it got standing, and B, I think that's it helped win the argument in the case before the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So we need to get clever, because these bastards that are against us are quite clever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, we're just trying to live free lives and be left alone, and we don't think about stuff like this. They're trying to oppress, and that is their raison d'etre. That's what gets them up in the morning.
Yeah.
How can I, you know, F with someone new today?
Yeah. And they live for it.
Yeah, they do live for it. And that's why we're always playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm getting tired of it. So it's time for us to like think of something clever.
Yeah.
Have a good test case on there and get this ball rolling.
This is kind of in the range of what you've talked about with Hologram. And since you mentioned that book a minute ago, explain to the listeners what the idea of the Hologram concept is.
I was doing some research on the Constitution in the mid-90s for other purposes that I think I've forgotten about now, and came across a truncated version of the preamble of the Constitution. And it basically says, we of the United States, you know, in order to blah, 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 do ordain and establish this Constitution for the USA. It's like, we of the US are doing this for the USA, if you truncate that even further.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why isn't it we of the USA are doing this for the USA, or we of the US doing it for the US?
Yeah.
It wasn't that way. It's we of the United States are doing this for the USA. And for my forensically legalistic, suspicious mind, this became very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked into it. And basically what happened is you had a pack of guys with nationalist and mercantilist proclivities come together, agitate for a different kind of central government arrangement. Beyond the Articles of Confederation, agitate for the convention, write this document, propagandize the thing in a fast break, and got it ratified pretty quickly within 2 years, and had a new government online 4 years after the Constitution had convened in Philadelphia in 1787.
It was essentially a coup.
It was a coup. It was a bloodless coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
It changed the arrangement of everything, and unfortunately the states, the people of the states, didn't quite understand how radical this really was, mainly because of the assurances of the Federalist Papers and some of the Hamiltonian types at the ratifying convention promising, no, it doesn't go this far, and you're reading too much into it, and can you imagine what the, you know, federal sheriffs would ever oppress the people? Why, the people would never allow it. The newspapers would sound the alarm. The militias would, you know, would muster and all this. Who can imagine such a case? Standing armies? Ha! You're dreaming. You know, this is all paranoia talk. So my book, Hologram of Liberty, goes back and analyzes who wrote the Constitution and why. And it wasn't the so-called Founding Fathers. We had two sets. We had the Revolutionary War set with Jefferson, Pat Henry, Sam Adams, John Hancock, and all those guys. But 10 years later, it's a different set of guys trying to grab the brass ring.
Yeah.
And they did. So that set, I'm calling the Founding Lawyers. And we need to understand what they wrote and why, and what its limitations are for liberty, which are quite extensive, and why the argument that we just need to go back to the Constitution, unquote, is going to be unavailing. We need to think beyond the Constitution, because I tell you, the statists of our time are already thinking beyond our Constitution, because it serves their purposes poorly also.
Michael W. Dean from the Freedom Fiends podcast, he and I were talking about a single word in the Second Amendment, to bear arms.
Yeah.
And I made the statement that to bear, like if you're on a ship and you bring your guns to bear, you're actually bringing them around onto another ship.
Right.
And my argument was that's what it meant.
Interesting.
To bear arms doesn't mean to carry. It means
not merely carry, but
to be able to actually have, like, out of a holster.
Right.
And Michael said, I think it just means to carry. And so I actually went into the history of the word to find out. And up until about the late 1600s, the word to bear, in reference to arms, literally meant to put somebody under, you know, under aim. Yeah. To bear arms meant to draw the arm and literally aim it at the other person, or, you know.
Right.
But about 1700, you know how some words come into trendy.
Yes.
Like we would say, well, that burrito place is bad, you know.
Right.
And you mean that's a really good burrito.
Fat.
Yeah.
P-H-A-T.
Yeah. Well, that is not new. People do that with language all the time.
Sure.
And around 1700. It became fashionable to blend the word bear to both carry and to brandish. And so, literally, at the time that the Second Amendment was written, the word could mean either one, to simply carry it or to openly bring it out in a defensive way.
Yeah, when you bring something to bear, that has a sense of finality, like it's on.
Yeah. Right? So, and how you translate just that part of the Second Amendment vastly changes.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if you're bearing a firearm, if you translate as just carrying, well, then you can make a law that says, oh, sure, you can carry a firearm, but it has to be disassembled in locked containers.
Right.
Each component separately locked into a separate. You know, technically, you're still bearing it.
Right.
But if you take it the other direction, then suddenly the firearm has a purpose.
Yeah, right.
And so just the cleverness, and I believe they knew what they were doing when they used that word rather than any variety of others that they could have clarified the point with.
I'd agree, just looking at and knowing what else they wrote and why. Very, very canny. You know, Madison was behind sifting through the 200 proposed, you know, amendments for what became the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, dumping most of them and rewriting some and streamlining them and all that. So the Second Amendment was originally a little longer. It basically had two sentences, and they truncated that, and it looked like, you know, the purpose was a subordinate clause, and so there was a big argument over that and so forth. So, I'm not at all surprised that he offered language to Congress that was somewhat ambivalent or ambiguous or vague, especially for the purposes of freedom. I'm not at all surprised that Madison did that thing.
Did I distract you from describing the hologram? I think I took this off.
We just diverted just a little bit. So basically, that book in 97, which I just revised and it came out 2 weeks ago, is about understanding the Constitution, who wrote it and why, and, you know, how far it can get us down the freedom road, And I think at this point it's become more of a liability than anything else. So it was due for a reprint this year. It's never been my best seller. It's my most leisurely seller. It always has been. It's only been reprinted once in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it was due for a reprint this year after its 08 reprint. And I thought, all right, I'm getting out of the political and philosophical, you know, total focus of my book writing so I can write other things. But I can't let this 1997 version go out in perpetuity. It just deserves more. I like the book a lot. My readers really like the book. I get the strongest positive feedback of all my books with that title. They'll say, this book just knocked me flat. It knocked me out. And it's the only book I've written that I didn't start out to write. And that particular book was not a goal of mine. It became a goal of mine. It sort of wrote itself in a way. So I wanted to do it justice with a revision and 100 new pages, especially talking about the 10th Amendment, Obamacare, and the decision that will come out next week. So I'm very happy that I did so, and I'm glad it's going out in a better, bigger version.
Yeah. And you were talking about a hologram.
Yes.
Being such that you can, it appears to be real.
Right.
Until you get up to it and test it. And then you see that it's image only.
It is. It's a projected image. And it's projected from a certain vantage point. And if you walk past that point of where its focal depth is to the viewer, if you walk past that, that image disappears.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't keep in front of you. So our so-called social and legal boundaries are holographic for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to constantly go up to them and see if it's hard or if it's just a holographic image. And if it's holographic, walk through and see where the real boundary is.
Yeah.
At least where the enforcement boundary of something is. I mean, too many people, especially businessmen, give the regulators such a hall pass on the laws. It should be, you know, your inspection this, your regulation, and screw you, you mm-hmm. know. You can't, you know, enforce this against everyone, so
yeah.
I'm going to try it. And people in the same industry or the same ilk need to, like, get together and go, yeah, I don't like this any more than you do. Let's push it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just got one guy that's collecting tax on this deal.
Yeah.
You know, can't be everywhere.
Oddly enough, this is happening in a strange industry in the food truck business.
Okay.
All in cities all across the United States. If you've got decent credit and $10,000, you can set yourself up with a very good business running a food truck.
Okay.
Or if you've got
a mobile kitchen. You
know, yeah, right. Yeah. And if you've got $40,000 or $50,000 laying around, you right. can do it without a debt, which would be
yeah.
really great.
Okay.
So there are restaurateurs that are saying, you know, if I have a restaurant in one place, mm-hmm. I get inspected by 20 different agencies on a regular basis. They're right. constantly coming around here.
Right.
And there's a, you know, having, I've worked in the restaurant industry somewhat,
mm-hmm.
and I know that, you know, not always, but sometimes according to if the right people get free food,
mm-hmm.
these inspections don't always happen, or they happen with a different
tone.
Yeah. Now, that's not always the case, of course,
right.
but it does happen.
Sure.
And so there are restaurateurs
yeah.
that are saying, you know, that's a lot of nonsense, and I can just buy this truck.
Mm-hmm.
And I can put on Facebook or tweet or whatever, we're going to be at 14th and N Street
mm-hmm.
at 9, and no inspections,
right.
no permits,
right.
nothing. Mm-hmm. And if things look bad, we'll just move to another street and put it on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are popping up all over the place.
Good.
And yeah, I'm thrilled by it.
Good.
They don't necessarily understand the deeper extent to how what it is that they're doing,
right.
which is really great. It's happening spontaneously.
Yeah, they're reacting just to immediate pinch and pain.
Yeah,
but that reaction has much wider, you know, benefits for liberty.
Yeah,
it's causing a new culture to.
And if we do that intentionally, right. planned out,
yeah,
there are all kinds of aspects of the market
yes.
that can just begin acting.
Absolutely.
And, but little things like that can be done.
Yeah.
If you get one pirate radio station,
right.
it can be taken down very quickly and easily.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have one in every town, or yeah. one in every major city,
right.
That turns into five in every major city, right. then they can't do anything about that.
No, they really can't.
You can't stop the, you know, you can't catch the rain. You might catch pieces of it, but you're not going to catch the rain.
That's right. Yeah, we need to be more like a gas. It's like, find the gas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I smell it, but where is it, you know?
Yeah.
It's in your nose, that's where it is, and, you know.
If somebody's going to buy one of your books,
mm-hmm.
what book should they buy first?
Our website is Javelin with a J, J-A-V-E-L-I-N Press, javelinpress.com. That has a listing of all our newest and revised titles. Also, all our books are sold on Amazon, so you can search either by Boston Tea Party or Kenneth W. Royce and get a list there. It's nice if you buy them directly from Javelin. We make a little more money. If you send cash or even a blank money order, you'll usually get a signed copy by me,
mm-hmm.
unless I'm out of town and I just can't do it immediately. But it's pretty reliable to get a signed copy. So Javelin Press has the address and so forth. As far as which books, I've written 13, seven of which are working titles. The other six mainly either got rolled over into bigger, better editions. One book I just stopped printing entirely was my first book, The Buyer for 15th, just because I thought there was better and newer information on the market by people more dedicated to that subject than I wanted to continue being. So of the seven working titles, I'll just list them and then chat briefly. Boston's Gun Bible, it's 850 pages. It's basically an almanac about all sorts of things regarding guns, safety, training, what to do after a shoot, you know, defensive shooting, battle rifles, testing them against each other, battle carbines, handguns, gun laws in the 50 states, federal gun laws, how to go out and buy a gun at a gun show,
mm-hmm.
you know, how to go to a gun show and get the most out of that day's experience. That's basically two-thirds of the book. The last third is a bunch of fun, rah-rah Second Amendment stuff. So that's my bestseller, which is surprising for, you know, a $33 retail book that's 850 pages. It's a big, fat, you know, brick of a book. And still my bestseller on Amazon. It's got like 175 reviews.
Wow.
And like 140 or something or five stars. So it's well-favored out there. And it needs a couple of factual addendums just because since 2008 or 2009, it was the last time I added any new pages. There have been new guns and some wrinkles that have come out, but instead of updating the whole book, which is, you know, 95%, you know, constant throughout a long time, the other 5% that it needs, I'm just going to put it on the website,
mm-hmm.
then, and people go there and get, you know, if I test the SCAR, the SCAR rifle or something like that, they can get that for free. So if you're not a gun owner, certainly get Boston's Gun Bible. And even if you are a gun owner and you don't have that, and know quite a bit about guns, and you have a history of shooting and so forth, there's going to be something in there that's worth the book for you, I guarantee it. So I'd say that'd be the first book to get. The next one, just from a usability standpoint, probably my You and the Police book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very thin book. It's only 168 pages, and it was last updated in 2009. And it's basically a sort of like a pocket handbook, as if a lawyer had written what your rights are during any police confrontation. And even though I'm not a lawyer, I'm a layman, a lot of lawyers have looked at it and no one's had any complaints.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dead on with my treatment of this stuff. So, if, you know, if you got stopped for a broken taillight, and then, sir, when you step back here, I'd like to search your trunk. You know, you'll know what to say. Instead
right.
of, oh, okay, I guess so.
Right.
You know, never consent. Never answer any questions that you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically your name, and you know, you give your license, and where are you headed? Well, that's private business.
Yeah.
What's in the briefcase? Lawful personal property.
Mm-hmm.
Can I look? No. You know, and that's about it. And basically saying, you know, I'd rather not answer that. I'd need to get somewhere. Am I free to go?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd just really like to look in the trunk. You got nothing to hide? Yeah. Well, I'm worried that you're trying to, you know, attach me to someone else's. I don't know why you stopped me. Maybe someone else in this car like this did something similar. I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
I'd like to go now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I care not to answer that. Am I free to go? If that's all you knew, and it doesn't take much of an IQ just to like be Rain Man, you know.
Right.
Qantas never crash, you know, that kind of thing. You just keep saying, you know, I'd prefer not to answer that. Am I free to go?
Yeah.
You run out the clock of the detention. You've been detained when you get pulled over. and they're trying to turn the detention into an arrest.
Right.
And to do that, they need to go from reasonable suspicion to probable cause. So their job, in their minds, is to get PC, probable cause. Your job is to keep things at the basic level and run out the clock, because they can't detain you forever.
Yeah.
20 minutes, 30 minutes is about what the courts will generally allow. And after that, there has to be, like, real reason this is taking longer. Like, they've called for a drug dog, and he's in the next county, and he's going to take an hour to get there. They have to use the least intrusive means and the most diligent to accomplish their investigative purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't do that, then the detention becomes unlawful.
Yeah.
So, basically, never consent. Do not answer questions. Keep asking if you're free to go.
Yeah.
Keep it at that level and drive away under your own speed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you and the police. Very useful book. It's only $16. After that, thinking of how to, I would say my privacy book, One Nation Under Surveillance, Privacy from the Watchful Eye. Very helpful book, especially regarding computers. People are just way too lax and naive and ignorant about basic computer security. It doesn't take much to get an account. It's a free account at Hushmail.
Mm.
Tell your friends and family to also get Hushmail accounts. And then between those two accounts at Hushmail, it's automatically encrypted.
Mm.
I show you how to pick and use and remember a very strong passphrase, where it's not Whiskers 123, because your cat
yeah.
is Whiskers and 123 is 123. I mean, that's easily broken in a brute force attack on a password. I mean,
right.
they can get that in minutes, if not hours.
Yeah, or your birthday and your home address or something.
Right. Yeah, if you had basic information on the target, you'd be 80% successful in getting a passphrase, that
yeah.
from someone. Your passphrase needs to be at least eight, if not 12 characters, and it needs to be a combination of upper and lowercase, numeric, and meta characters. Those are like the question sign, the asterisk, the exclamation sign, things like that. So if you added one number and a question mark to Whiskers 123, and made Whiskers a capital W,
yeah.
got upper, lower, numerical, and all that, that's a whole lot better. Whiskers 123, with an exclamation mark,
mm-hmm.
that is 10 times stronger than just lowercase Whiskers 123.
Yeah.
Because you've added the other data fields of your capitals and your meta characters. And I've got other tips on making even stronger passphrases that someone can remember.
Yeah.
So that's very important. I mean, getting a proxy. Why are you online directly through your local ISP who can see everything that you can see?
Yeah.
Unless it's an HTTPS SSL protected page,
mm-hmm.
and that's not all that common. You should have a foreign proxy. Through your ISP, you form a tunnel, a data tunnel that they can't look into. They just see streams of data that they don't know what it means, data packets, and they don't know where you visit after that. These are things that cost, what I just described costs less than $200 a year.
Now, the nice thing about that, too, is it's kind of like what we're talking about with the other things like food trucks and so forth.
Yeah.
If more people are doing that, even, somebody might say, well, I don't have to do that because nothing I'm doing needs to be, I don't have anything to hide or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not really the point at all here.
No, it's not.
The more of us that do that on a regular basis, the more, essentially, the more food trucks are out there, the more radio stations
exactly.
are out there.
Right.
And the data mining that they're going to do
mm-hmm.
becomes that much more difficult for people when it really is important that they keep that stuff private.
Exactly. Yeah, I'd like to talk about that after the break.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, well, this is a good time to break anyway. And that's the first half of the interview with Boston Tea Party here at Porcupine Festival 2012, the New Hampshire Porcupine Liberty Festival. Be sure and check back with badquaker.com. We will be updating with further interviews, including the second half of this interview with Boston Tea Party. We have coming up an interview with Stefan Molyneux and lots of other people that we found here walking around at Porkfest 2012. So be sure and check back with badquaker.com for more from Porcupine Festival 2012. Thank you very much, folks.